Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Welcome to the Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. I am delighted, thrilled, and euphoric that you are here today. That is, it is the trifecta of happiness that you have decided to join us this evening. Welcome aboard. Glad you can be with us. We have a jam-packed, unbelievably full show today. We will, of course, be talking later this hour about the Prime Minister's testimony at the Foreign Interference Inquiry. Don't know that he said much, which I don't think anyone's too surprised by, but what did he say? We will get into that. We're going to be talking about the RBC Canadian Open. You know that that tournament is in Hamilton this year, in Ancaster, at Hamilton Golf and Country Club. Announcements today and some interesting stuff going on with that. We'll be talking about that in a minute. Chrystia Freeland, you know that there is a budget coming. And one of the interesting parts about this is she was asked a question about tax increases, and she said, well, I'm not raising taxes on the middle class. Now, it's an interesting answer because if you recall, at the beginning of this government's term, they created a minister for the middle class. Remember that? And then when the minister for the middle class was asked, well, who is in the middle class? What constitutes the middle class? The minister had no idea how to answer that question. So we've never defined what the middle class is. But we're not going to have a tax increase on the middle class. So there's the good news. But the suggestion is that people are now inferring from this, should we be bracing for a wealth tax or a bigger hit on corporations? And will that be good? Will it make us feel better? Or will it be not so good for our economy? We'll get into that. And at the end of the show, we will be talking about yet another. It's unbelievable to me. It's unbelievable to me that our politicians seem as disinterested in stuff as they do. But I don't know if you heard this story, but there was a recent trip, an Indo-Pacific goodwill mission with the Prime Minister and 50 other people. And the amount of money that was spent on airline food is staggering. This is after we've had the Governor General get dumped on for overwhelming spending and other politicians. How is it that no politician still seems to give a whoop about how much money of our money, taxpayers' dollars, they are spending? Why is it that politicians somehow feel they have graduated to kinghood or queenhood? I don't get it. We'll talk about that later in the show. First off, though, today, I wanted to mention this. Last night, we were having a bit of a chuckle, if you were here, because the person who was the presumptive owner of an expansion Salt Lake City NHL team, remember we were talking about this last night? They wanted some names, some possible names for a team if a team was going to come there. And some of them were not bad. Some of them were absurd. Some of them were stupid. Anyway, we were thinking yesterday when we had that discussion that, well, you know, that's they got time because it's going to be an expansion team and that'll be years down the road because we just had Las Vegas and then we just had Seattle. They're not going to expand again anytime soon. News today that it appears the Arizona Coyotes could be moving to Salt Lake City as early as next season. They could be playing in Salt Lake City as early as the start of next season. Which, on the one hand, is probably a very good thing because I can't imagine there's been a sports entity that has failed as hard as the NHL in Arizona. It's had successes. Don't forget, Auston Matthews came from there. So the team has spun off some fringe benefits of finding some kids who are interested. But as an NHL franchise, it's been a disaster. They're playing in a university arena right now. They're not even the prime tenant in that arena. They can't find an arena that works, on and on and on. It's good. Get them out of there. Be done with it. But, when I heard today that they might be moving to Salt Lake City, you know, the rancor got up a little bit. The ire got going a little bit. How is it that a team that couldn't work in the southern United States, that once upon a time was almost moved to Hamilton. How is it that Salt Lake City is now getting a team and not us? And I know, like, the Maple Leafs and the boundaries and all that. That's not even what I'm talking about. That stuff is fixable. Somehow, the fact that now Phoenix and Scottsdale and all these cities have failed miserably, and now you're going to go to Salt Lake City, which has not cared about hockey since the Olympics in 1992. Was Salt Lake City? 92, I think? Or 96? One of those. Anyway, we haven't heard anything about hockey. How is it that somehow the NHL has decided that is a better market for an NHL team than here? Or even, let's be generous, even Quebec City. Quebec City would be a tremendous, and if you're saying, well, you know, Quebec City is too small, Salt Lake City is something like the 50th largest city in the States. Salt Lake City is not one of these gigantic urban metropolises. Houston would make more sense. Houston's like, I think, the fourth biggest market in the States. Houston, okay, I mean, would make sense. No, not Houston. We're going to take it to Salt Lake City. While Hamilton and Quebec City sit here dying for a team, eager for a team, we're about to have a brand new, well, not a brand new, but a newly refurbished arena. Quebec City has a brand new arena. You've got a built-in hockey market. It would make money. It would sell tickets guaranteed. You would have rivalries built in. And yet you want to go to Salt Lake City. I mean, frankly, it's amazing to me that they haven't yet proposed like Sheboygan, Wisconsin. You know, let's throw it. Let's throw another team in California. Let's go to, I don't know. Let's put it on the Mexican border. Let's have the Tijuana Tigers. They probably put it there before they would put it in Hamilton. I guarantee it. I mean, good that they're getting out of Arizona if in fact this happens. But how? I just every time this happens, all I can and remember the Arizona Coyotes. Jim Balsillie, remember? We're supposed to be here in Hamilton. The NHL absolutely fought it to the end of the earth. That could not happen. They could not leave. But apparently they might be able to leave to go to Salt Lake City. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Some days, I tell you, some days, it does make you wonder. You wonder what would happen if all the people across Canada for a little while, who were not in the main, not in the seven cities that had a team. If everyone else in the country just stopped watching hockey, ratings would go way down. Suddenly revenues for the NHL would go way down. Maybe then somebody would listen, but I doubt it. Anyway, Salt Lake City, enjoy that one. Could have been Hamilton. Could have been Quebec City. Salt Lake City. As always, the first segment of the Scott Radley Show is brought to you exclusively by Fox40Shop.com for sport and for safety. It has to be. Fox40Shop.com. Enter the promo code Radley at checkout, and you will get 25% off your order. Lots coming back. We're going to talk about the RBC Canadian Open. Some announcements today. We're getting very close. Believe it or not, we're getting very close to that tournament being here in Hamilton, even though it doesn't exactly feel summery just yet. We're almost there.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Not summery yet, but there were signs of it over the last little while. It was pleasant, but it still surprises me a little bit, still catches me a little off guard that we are really only 6 weeks away from Hamilton hosting the RBC Canadian Open. It still seems a lot closer to winter than it has to summer, but we're getting there. But yes, 6 weeks, May 28 is when that week kicks off with the RBC Canadian Open up at the Hamilton Golf and Country Club in Ancaster. And today was the first of what I expect will be a number of announcements to do with things that will be going on at that event. A lot of people from this city go. A lot of people from this city go, which is why we want to talk about it. Brian Crawford is the tournament director of the RBC Canadian Open. Joins us now. Brian, how are you today? Hello, Brian. Do we have Brian? You know what? We're going to try and sort out Brian. And we will get him back. But the announcement today, I'll tell you while we are waiting to hear. So they announced today, because remember last time it was here in 2019, they introduced the concerts on the grounds. It was a sort of an ironic twist because, you know, golf course is the quietest place on earth generally. And they decided to have concerts. They had Florida Georgia Line and they had the Glorious Sons. You may remember, you may have been there. you particularly may remember because on the Friday night when they had Florida-Georgia line, it happened to be the night of game two of the NBA final. The Raptors were playing in it, so everyone watched the concert, had a great time, stayed around. Then they put the game up on the screens and everyone stayed around to cheer for the Raptors. Well, today, as I say, in the wake of that, 5 years hence, they are having more concerts there. And today they announced who was going to be playing. Brian Crawford now joins us. Brian, how are you?
Hi, Scott. I'm doing well, thanks.
There we go. Technology is a wonderful thing until it isn't, right?
So, yeah, absolutely.
So you made an announcement today. The concert, before we get to who you announced, let's just go back 5 years, because when you brought the concerts, when you had the idea to do concerts at a golf tournament, it seemed like a bit of an oxymoron. It seemed a little ironic because golf courses are very, very quiet places traditionally. Where did that idea even come from that it could work?
Yeah, well, we had the great fortune of having our title partner be also so heavily invested into music as well through RBC's RBCX Music initiative. And so, you know, they thought about how they could really merge those two parts of their business together and wanted to, you know, figure out how that could happen at the Canadian Open. And thankfully, we were able to work together with the host club that really got on board for doing that and bring the RBCX Music Concert Series to Hamilton back in 2019 for the first time. So that's kind of the genesis of really trying to make the tournament a real sport and entertainment property about more than just golf, introduce new fans to the world of golf and to what it is that the national championship is all about.
Were you at all surprised, even though, I mean, obviously Florida Georgia Line was really big and Gloria Sons were a name brand that were going to come in, were you at all surprised at how well it went over, that as many people came and as many people stuck around and all that? Like the success of it, was it at all a surprise to you?
You know, I mean, that was the strategy going in. You know, that's what we were aiming for, and that's what, that's why everybody got behind it and invested in bringing it forward. I think maybe the response specifically to Florida Georgia Line was maybe surprising that it was, such a massive response, from the Canadian public and golf fans for that particular artist. But, you know, both nights were wildly successful and really, set us off on what has now become, truly a pillar for the tournament, and that's the musical component of the event.
I will let you then take the opportunity, because you made an announcement today, I will let you say who is going to be coming and playing this year.
Yeah, we were really thrilled to announce two artists today, with a few more to come in a couple weeks' time, but headlining Friday night is going to be one of Canada's biggest rock bands of all time in Our Lady Peace, that will be playing Friday night. Multiple Juno Awards and dozens of hit singles and platinum albums. So we're really excited to have them performing and celebrating the 30th anniversary of their very first album release, Navid. So that's going to be Friday night. And then Saturday, perhaps one of the hottest young voices in Canadian music and certainly in Canadian country, a local boy, Josh Ross, is coming back to his roots, back to Canada and back to the Hamilton area to perform on Saturday night as part of a country night. So we're really thrilled to have those two great artists performing and putting on a great show for all the fans that'll be there.
Are you, we only have a minute or so left, but this is a moving target. I don't mean the concerts. When the Canadian Open first came back to Hamilton in 2003, first time back since 1930, it was played in mid-September, same in 2006. 2012, it was late July. 2019, it was middle of June. Now it's late May. Is it a challenge always having these moving dates, or is that no big deal to constantly be sort of on the move?
Yeah, I mean, we've been relatively consistent since 2019. I mean, we're a week earlier this year than we were the last several years, including 2019. It's only actually a week earlier in the PGA Tour's calendar. So we've been relatively consistent at the the start of the summer season and the start of the golf season, really kicking off summer, which we've really loved the last couple of years since 2019. So, I think we found a really great sweet spot in the calendar for our event and in the sports calendar and the Canadian summer calendar to take place. I wasn't around for, you know, all but one. I was only around for one of the July events in 2018, and was only a neighbor of the event when it was back in September. So the June and late May dates have really proved to be fantastic for us, and we're excited to be able to launch summer in Canada.
If anyone's interested, and I assume some people will be, and I assume some listening have not followed up anything yet, if people want to go, want to get a ticket, or want to look into more of it, where do they go?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find tickets on Ticketmaster or right from the RBC Canadian Open website, which is probably the best place to go and get your tickets direct. And we've got a whole variety. And, you know, I've been really thrilled to see tickets selling at an unbelievable rate this year, well ahead of last year, which would be record-setting for us once again back here in Hamilton. So, you know, the community obviously supports the tournament, perhaps like very few others, and we're thrilled to be back at what is one of the best golf courses in the country.
That is Brian Crawford. He is the tournament director of the RBC Canadian Open, Hamilton guy too. Appreciate it. Brian, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Today was a day that I think a lot of people were interested in seeing at the foreign election interference hearings, because the Prime Minister was going to be testifying. And sure enough, he has and did. And some interesting things that have come out of this. I want to bring in Dr. Robert Hewish. He is an associate professor with the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. Doctor, thanks for this today.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Great to be here.
So normally I wouldn't do this, because normally I would just begin by asking you some stuff and getting into a conversation. But you know what? I think it's only in this case fair to say, is there anything that stood out to you from Prime Minister Trudeau's testimony today before I start getting into some of the questions I have? Anything that leapt off the page that really struck you today?
Well, you know how they say with like good music or like a good comedic routine, sometimes it's the pauses or the silence that really delivers the message behind it. And that's kind of what I was with. Felt in hearing the testimony today, is that there was a lot out there to be missed. And what I mean by that is we were very much aware now in 2024, the extent of Chinese interference, the government of China in Canada, in the US, in Australia, in New Zealand, and in Great Britain, all the Five Eyes got targeted. So to hear a sort of a silence around the idea that some of the details can't be disclosed for fear of giving over the cover of particular agents, I don't think that's a sort of silence of a response that doesn't really weigh in. I was expecting a lot more. I was expecting something that would get to the deeper message about what was known, why it happened, what are the impacts? Why should people be concerned about this if it's in government or in other institutions across the country? So it was that sort of silence that came from it that was remarkably disappointing.
I'm going to come back exclusively to the Prime Minister in a second. But before that, I mean, with the people we heard today and even in the last bit, the one thing that's really struck me is apparently, even with what you just said, which is, I believe, 100% true, apparently nobody's at fault for any of this. There is simply nobody who should be standing up to say, you know, I missed something or I overlooked something or I didn't read this document. Nobody was at fault for anything in this.
Yeah. And let's be very cognizant of the timetable when this interference towards an election was taking place. It was around the early days of COVID. That was part of it. And there was all sorts of partnerships that were being engaged with the government of China and with Canada, with various branches from, particularly with the vaccine development technology. Let's just forget that it was Canada's original plan to develop a vaccine in collaboration with Chinese scientists in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. We had researchers in Halifax, we had researchers in Winnipeg who were producing it, sent the recipe over to China and hope that it would be returned to us, and it wasn't, right? So that actually put us way behind everybody else in the G7 in terms of actually getting access to vaccines because of that initial plan. But, you know, there's more to it, Scott. Like, something that I've been looking at for the past few years is the way that China has used its internal infrastructure to create this influence abroad. What we know now in 2024, not just from government testimony, but from actual research, from other people coming forward and saying, hey, this happened to me, from the experience of other governments around the world, we know very clearly that the Chinese government has a whole branch called the United Workers Front that's dedicated to interfering in the business of other countries. And it's 30,000 people strong who work in this one, you know, department of bureaucracy in China. And it's something that doesn't have to be strategic. They are able to just try, you know, 1,000 cuts and see which one works. They're able to do all sorts of experiments about who they can gain favor to. And if it hits, it hits. If it misses, no big deal. And the fact that none of the exposure of the government of China's tactics really came out today, either by the prime minister's testimony or by others, is a little defeating. Like I feel that we should follow what other countries who have been taken by Chinese influence in the past, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and they've been incredibly transparent. I mean, take a quick browse through the FBI publicly available website, and you'll see that in 2022, the FBI was opening up a new case on Chinese interference every 12 hours.
Wow.
It was remarkable.
And again, when I said that nobody was taking the blame, I didn't expect anybody to throw themselves under the bus or throw someone else under the bus. But even the idea of, you know, there was a lot going on. It was trying to drink out of a fire hose. And yeah, you know what? I missed something. I wish I'd caught something. We didn't even get that there was an acknowledgement of, you know, there was just so much to do that I'm sorry I missed that. I wish I had a better crack, a second crack at it. I would have caught it. Not even that I heard, not even that.
Yeah, no. And I think it's maybe time to recognize that this is beyond partisan politics. This is something that, you know, ties into the fact just yesterday announcements were made about new Arctic defense spending. And it was, you know, directed at a potentially, nuclear ambitious Russia coming into Canadian territory. But China was also, you know, subtly mentioned in that new strategy for defense spending in Canada. So let's be real about this. Let's look at, yeah, let's prepare for the conflict tomorrow, but let's also acknowledge what kind of conflict we were in today. And, you know, we know exactly how China has tried to push influence on all sectors of Canadian society. So first off, municipal governments, right? They have received pressure from people who've been influenced by, not usually working for, Scott, I should say, it should be influenced by United Workers Front, which is in China, and how that's played out. We also see how universities have been deeply influenced, right? All of them. I don't think there's a single one in Canada that hasn't had some sort of brush with this, to the point where CSIS was very, very public. They put out calls to academics. They're like, do you feel something weird is happening? Because it probably is. Call us. We can confirm it, right? Like it's been very, very open about that. And also how we see both in China and in other countries, the idea about getting huge market buy from particular regional sectors. Seafood in Nova Scotia, pork in the prairies, beef, Alberta beef falls into it every now and then. You basically look for the regional products that suddenly have a huge market potential in China, all luxury goods by and large, and that tap can be turned off if the political culture gets to be disharmonious from Beijing's point of view. As a result, you have now political lashback in Nova Scotia, you've got political lashback in Alberta, and it's going to be the regional voices that then pressure the federal government. The very same tactic, Scott, was put in Australia to the point where wine farmers, beef farmers felt the same way, ditto for New Zealand, dairy and wine. And we know that in those two countries, there were representatives they were connected to the United Front, Workers Front, that were running for office in Australia and another one at a municipality in New Zealand. So to think that Canada somehow has been immune to this, or to think that
pretty naive,
we can't be emotionally prepared to talk about the details, It just doesn't cut it, Scott, because academics like myself or others will eventually expose it.
One more thing, and this one is one of the problematic things that I think we heard today, and maybe it's not problematic, maybe it only strikes me as such, but last year at a hearing, Katie Telford, his chief of staff, the prime minister's chief of staff, says, of course he reads all documents, all briefings, security briefings, and everything that he gets. Today, the prime minister says, no, I don't read everything. I rely on my people to update me if something is important or to give me a verbal thing. I don't apparently read all my security briefings. If something's really important, somebody tells me this. That sounds like a giant crack in the sidewalk that things are sliding through. If his chief of staff is saying he's reading it and he's saying, no, I'm waiting for someone to tell me this, stuff is clearly going to be missed, isn't it?
Oh yeah, and that is again how the transition from intelligence gathering, public policy to then political leadership roles. I mean, it's something that we can expect that the political leaders do not have enough time and days that they have to go over every detail. So they do rely on their staff. So if there's someone in the staff who didn't present that forward or who said that this was not a big enough issue to do so, that's an issue. But clearly it should have been. I think with something that you know is being briefed to you by CSIS that is occurring in your ally nations, it wouldn't be something that you would roll under the table. It's something that would have to be discussed at some level. So therein lies the real root of it. Where was the message disconnect? Because the CSIS agents, the other partners in the Five Eyes are collecting data on this, and it is coming out, and we're seeing how other countries have been very clear about it. So why are we kind of shrugging our shoulders about it? To me, that says there's some sort of disconnect from what the PMO's office was either presenting on his desk or presenting to the public and what the intelligence gathering community was doing. So, like you said, if someone's to blame, probably in that mix right
Well,
there.
we got to run, but here's the thing I don't get is if you are saying I don't read all the documents, but I'm relying on my staff to make sure that I know of anything really important, and stuff that's really important, according to him, didn't get passed to him, surely that would mean that that person who was responsible would no longer be working because you couldn't trust them then to look after this very important task. Has anybody from the PMO's office been fired? I don't think so. And
No,
so I don't
and I
get.
and I
I
no,
don't get
I don't
what's
think
being
so
done. I
at
don't get
all.
what's being done.
That's right, and that's probably where the questions are going to lie. Who physically got to the top level of reading that intelligence portfolio? Who presented it, and then who withheld it?
Well, and if you're
And then.
not going to get rid of that person, you clearly, I would argue, aren't taking this all that seriously to think that that needs to be done better. But again, I wish we had a lot more time. Dr. Robert Hewish from Dalhousie University. A great conversation. Thanks for doing this today.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks again.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
It is time for Tom's story of the day. Now, just to confuse everybody, this is Tom number two. We have multiple Toms, just like we have multiple Scotts here at the station. We try to make sure there's a backup for every name, just so generally we don't even have to explain it. We just say, Scott or Tom or whoever. We haven't got a second Rick yet. We will. We'll give it time. We will. But anyway, here's how this works. I'm going to give Tom three unusual stories from around the world. Tom's the guy, by the way, in case you're wondering, who does all the levers and buttons and things. He's the guy who does the real work here. I'm going to give him three stories from around the world. He will hear them. He will think about them. He will maybe discuss them. He'll call a friend. Do they still have that thing with the like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where you can phone a friend, ask the audience, I don't know. And at the end he will decide which one he likes best. That's Tom's story of the day. It's very simple. Let us begin, Tom, in Germany,
Okay.
where a modern art gallery has fired one of its employees because he had the audacity to drill two extra holes in the wall and hang two of his own paintings. Now, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, okay, now, some people listening are going to be very offended when I say this, but modern art, you could probably have almost anyone do almost anything and pass it off as modern art. How offensive is it really? I know it's not this guy's gallery, so okay, technically, but to fire, why not just say, please don't do this again?
Yeah, does it, I mean, like, did he, you know, maybe drill through the wall into another piece of art?
No, he was in Munich's Pinakothek der Moderne, and my German pronunciation is terrible, but anyway. And the gallery says that the artwork was not on display for very long, and the gallery people, and they weren't gigantic. Well, they were 60 centimeters by 120 centimeters, so they were big enough.
Yeah.
But it's not like he splashed paint on it. It's not like they were obscene. It was moderate. It could have been, I don't know what it was. It could have been like just splashes on a white background.
Macaroni drawing?
Yeah, it could have been anything. It could have been a pile of diapers. And you say, oh, modern art. I mean, anyway, I find that kind of an excessive use of firing capacity. But anyway, that's a guy, all he did to get fired was put up two of his own pieces of modern art. He didn't even sell them and pocket the money. Story number two comes to us from Australia in New South Wales, where a racehorse somehow got free from its paddock.
Oh my.
And disappeared. And I don't know if they lost sight of this racehorse. I don't know if it was in the middle of the night. It's unclear exactly how this racehorse got away, but it got away. Well, it was discovered on security camera standing on the the area of a subway waiting to get on a train.
Oh.
Yeah, it was standing on the platform of a subway train behind the yellow line, mind you.
Very polite.
With its cover still on and with people just looking going, why is there a racehorse in the subway? And nobody, the security camera highlighted that the horse was there, and I guess they came in. I don't think he got on the subway. That would have been even better.
I'm amazed he had fare.
It doesn't really say how he got through. That's a very good point.
Horses are big animals. Like, when one of those wants to move in your space, you make space for it. I've been on the business end of them a few times. They are scary.
But you're right. I mean, now it doesn't say how he got through the, thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. Story number two. Story number three. This one's in Scotland, and this is a person who I think needs to be more exposed to pop culture. Police in Scotland received a frantic phone call about a man at a train station who was armed. And, of course, Scottish police respond with the force and numbers that you would expect to respond to a man in a subway or a train station, I guess, who is armed. It was a person dressed as a stormtrooper. It was a cosplayer in their stormtrooper outfit holding a laser gun, a fake laser gun, a toy laser gun. And somebody didn't identify that this person was a... Who has not seen a stormtrooper before?
Yeah, I am a cosplayer, actually. My policy is generally... Don't assume anybody knows your weapons are fake. Keep them, you know, under wraps until you are in the convention center. That being said, if you are in full stormtrooper armor...
You would think.
Yeah, one assumes that some connections are being made here.
I mean, even if you're not a fan of Star Wars movies, you assume. I think it's a reasonable assumption that people have seen a stormtrooper before. Yeah. What would have been the call to police if someone had come on the platform dressed as Darth Vader? I mean, can you imagine or Chewbacca? We've got a Bigfoot. Yeah. We found Bigfoot. I mean, it's anyway. Will your story of the day today be the German art gallery employee who was fired for hanging two of his own paintings? Will it be the escaped racehorse who was discovered in a Australian subway? Or will it be the Scottish cosplayer dressed as a stormtrooper that elicited massive police response for an armed man in a train station?
Oh, I got to stick with my community. It is Scottish stormtrooper cosplay. Please don't overreact, people.
And what is your cosplay outfit?
Many of them, but I'm best known as Arthur Morgan from Red Dead Redemption.
I have no idea what that is, but okay, I'll look it up during the news break.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
So we know that there's a budget coming up as we move on here. We know there's a budget coming up. And the other day, Chrystia Freeland was asked about taxes because, I mean, heaven knows our debt is growing seemingly by the day. In the last week and a bit, the government has made $20 billion plus in new commitments for a variety of things. Our debt is enormous. So the question, I think it was a perfectly reasonable question, was, will we see new taxes in this budget? And the answer was one of those, well, read through the lines perhaps answers, which was, we're not going to be taxing the middle class. I'm paraphrasing. We're not going to be taxing the middle class. Now, this is an interesting answer because, as you'll recall, a number of years ago when this government came into power in Ottawa, they created a minister of the middle class who promptly was asked, can you please define for us what is the middle class? And they could not. Nobody has properly been able to define what the middle class is. It's a great talking point. It's a fantastic thing because I guess most people feel like they are middle class or hope to be middle class. What is the middle class? Middle class is whatever you want it to be. It really is. But anyway, Chrystia Freeland says, no, we're not going to be taxing the middle class. However, that led to a follow-up, which was about a wealth tax. Will wealthy Canadians or corporations, will companies be facing heftier taxes in this budget? And if such a thing was to happen, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? Let's bring in Ian Lee. He is associate professor with the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University, favorite guest of ours. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Scott.
I appreciate you doing this. It's let's start by answering the question with the human response, I think, which is most of us, if the really rich people in this country got taxed more, I think it probably would make us feel good to know that the rich people were having the pound of flesh taken off their bottom line and they weren't as rich as they are. And we could feel good about that. I don't think there's any doubt about that. That's the human response. But from a practical economic stance, is it a good thing if we put in a wealth tax on the wealthiest people and the wealthiest corporations?
I have to narrow it down, narrow your question down just to be clear. Are we, because people often mix up income and wealth. They're not the same thing. You can have a high income and have no wealth, no assets, and vice versa. So we have to be clear, are we talking an income tax or an increase in income taxes on the top 1% or some wealthy definition, or are we talking a tax on their wealth? These are not academic distinctions. There's been huge studies on this in Europe and elsewhere. It's a lot easier to tax income. Let me put it that way.
Sure. And it's unclear. It's unclear what exactly, and that's part of the discussion here. It's unclear exactly because I don't think that Chrystia Freeland was very specific on this, but okay, let's break it down then. Let's take the two sides. If so, this was an income tax.
And I want to put some facts on, and this is straight out of CRA and Stats Canada. This may shock some people and some people may not believe me. So I urge them to go Google to StatsCan to get the data that I'm looking at on my screen to talk about this. Let's talk about income right now. We'll get to assets in a moment. I do have the data on gross assets in Canada for individuals as distinct from corporations. So this is 2021 data, the most recent data available. I mean, we only just filed our taxes for 23, so that data hasn't been collected. They're still working on 22. So the last reported year of aggregated data is 2021, which is relatively recent in the world of tax statistics, okay? So the top 1%, when you think of the top 1%, at least I do, and I'm sure many people do, we think of really rich people like Bill Gates or Taylor Swift, who made $1 billion last year on her tour. That was her gross income before her expenses of, you know, the roadies and the equipment and so forth. So, but she grossed $1 billion. That was her income. Patrick Mahomes in the States makes $50 million a year playing football. That's his gross income. Okay. The top 1% in Canada, the threshold value, as Stats Canada calls it. In other words, what is the minimum amount of money you have to make in Canada to be in the top 1%? Answer, $271,000. Now, Scott, I'm not a young person anymore. I don't make that, by the way. But I don't think of $271,000 as uber rich. I think of that as upper middle class and upper middle class. Medical doctors are probably mostly in the top that definition, which is the StatsCan data from CRA. Most of the medical doctors probably make over $270,000 a year. I know that Superior Court judges do because I looked at it. It's statutory and they make, I think it's $335,000. So they're in the top 1%. Presidents of universities and colleges, maybe some school principals, I don't know. And certainly CEOs of big corporations do. But my point is, the people, and StatsCan makes this very clear, most of the people in the top 1% are wage earners. They have a job. They're not Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, who have enormous wealth and don't work in the normal sense of the word like you and I do, with a job, you know, Monday to Friday. So 271,000 puts you in the top 1%. There may be people listening to this show right now who are in the top 1% and didn't even know it. The second point is because, and this is why I'm so critical of this government when they start playing games on this file. We got to go after the rich, you know, as if there's gazillions of rich people in Canada and they're not paying their taxes. I'll get to that one in a moment. In 2021, there were 290,000 Canadians out of 30 million taxpayers. 30 million people filed a tax return to CRA. How do I know? Because CRA has reported that. There were just, let's just round that number. 300,000 Canadians were in the top 1%. It was 292, but close enough. 300 is a nice round number. Now, 300,000 Canadians out of 30 million Canadians is not gazillions and millions of Canadians. It's a very tiny number. And as I've said already, they're mostly salary wage earners. They're not capitalists that own companies, most of them. The third point I want to put on the table before we get to the wealth tax is that I've heard the NDP say this. I've heard Mr. Trudeau say it. The high income people aren't paying their fair share of taxes. Well, the data is available from CRA, aggregated data. The top two quintiles, that's the top 40% of Canadians by income. And this is straight out of the CRA data from people filing their tax returns. The top 40% of Canadians pay 84% of all the taxes. The bottom 40%, and there's some people listening who may get very angry at what I'm saying, and there's no point getting angry at me because this is StatsCan and Canada Revenue Agency data. The bottom 40% of Canadians pay 5.7% of the taxes in Canada. So that's the progressive income tax system. We all know about, at least I hope we all know about, the progressive income tax system. The more you make, the higher the rate of tax you pay. It's not, we don't have a flat tax in Canada. You don't just pay a flat tax. As your income goes up, the percentage of tax goes up. And that's a progressive income tax system. So the top two quintiles pay lots of taxes, and people in the bottom 40%, the bottom two quintiles, pay very little in the way of taxes. So I'm not saying they shouldn't pay more. Maybe Ms. Freeland thinks they should be paying, instead of 84% of the taxes, maybe she thinks they should pay 100% of the taxes. You know, that can be debated. But the point is, they are paying a lot of taxes. It's false to say they're not paying a lot of taxes. And then we can debate how much they should be paying, even more or less, and so forth. The second point to walk before we go to the wealth issue is there's only a very small number of Canadians in the top 1%, just under 300,000 Canadians out of 30 million Canadians that filed tax returns. We're not talking corporations, nonprofits. We're not talking governments. We're talking us, we the people. There's 41 million Canadians in total, 30 million of us filed tax returns. The other 11 million are people, I presume, under the age of 18. They're minors, they're children. So they don't file tax returns. That's why there aren't 41 million tax returns in Canada, because those are children in public school, high school, maybe some are 1 year old in daycare. Okay, so there's 30 million adults filing tax returns, and only 300,000 are in the top 1%. So if she says, I really want to go after all those, quote, all those rich people, she's only got a very small pool of less than 300,000. And they're already paying very high rates of tax. Maybe they should pay more, but there you go. Let me turn very quickly, Scott, to the wealth side, because this is much more controversial. And there have been really good papers published by economists in the OECD on this, by Finance Canada, by academics in universities. And there was a study done just a year or two ago at the UK. It was a government of Britain, a government of Great Britain study. They sponsored the study or commissioned the study. And it is just rife with complications. Because, you know, which wealth are you talking? Are you talking real estate? Are you talking a tax on capital gains, tax on the principal residence of people? Because that's wealth. Are we talking a tax on art? Are we talking a tax on investments? Well, we already do tax investments. We have a capital gains tax on all capital gains. So are we talking a higher capital gains tax? Or are we saying there should be a special tax on top of the capital gains tax? And then how do you measure the wealth? People may say that's really easy. Well, I think anybody who thinks about this for about a nanosecond knows that wealth the value of something can change by the minute. We see it with real estate. We see it with cars. We see it with just about any kind of investment. It fluctuates. It goes up and the value of a Picasso painting, if you're well lucky enough to own one. I don't own any paintings whatsoever. I'm a poor professor. But what is the value of a Picasso? I have no idea. I really don't have any idea. And I've been in art galleries and seen original Picassos. I have no idea what they're worth. You know, stocks, if they're publicly traded, are much easier to track because there's a stock exchange price. But people don't realize the vast, vast number of corporations are not on the stock exchange. There's 2 million corporations in Canada, according to StatsCan. Only 3,500 approximately are listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So that means 1,997,000 approximately companies are not traded on the stock exchange. How do you value them to put a wealth tax on them? So it is horrendously complex if you're talking a wealth tax on assets.
But wouldn't the, let me jump in for a second, because wouldn't the idea of a wealth tax, this is, see, I think that, and thank you for explaining it. I think when most people think about tax the rich, they are not thinking about income tax. They are thinking about the people who are the multi-billionaires, the Bill Gates or right. whoever, right. whatever famous rich person you want to talk about. And we hear that, you know, Jeff Bezos now has a personal, he's worth $150 billion. Well,
200.
Forbes
certified him as going, his net worth is now $200 billion because share prices go up all the time. All so right. you have to constantly be revaluing.
He's now worth $200 billion. So we should be able to take 150 because look, even that leaves him with $50 billion, which is way more than any human being needs. So tax him to take away $150 billion. What would be wrong with that? Because he can surely live on $50 billion.
Of course he can. Of course he can. So now what we're talking about is the expropriation of wealth. So what we're saying is these people who earned it because they took risk and they started a company. He did. He started Amazon all by himself and took great risk at the time. People say there was no risk. Way back in 1995, I was doing interviews saying I thought that Amazon was not going to succeed. I was very dismissive of him because he was losing money year after year. Amazon lost money for the first 25 years. And I used to be quite sarcastic in my media interviews. I said, well, you know, Bezos is going to, he's going to make it up on volume, you know, his losses. Because I was being sarcastic, obviously. And he took great risks and he grew the company, as we all know, into the behemoth that it is today. So the argument is, and I understand what you're saying, and I know I'm not saying you're advocating it, but it's out there.
It is the argument. It is the argument.
They need all that money. So why don't we just take it from them? Well, they did that in 1917 in the Soviet Union. I've studied that revolution because I'm fascinated by the, I've been to Moscow, by the way. And I've studied the Russian Revolution. It's fascinating. They expropriated. There was private property in Russia prior to 1917. And they expropriated it. The government said, we're taking it because you have way more than you need. So we're taking it from you. And then it's all going to be owned by the state. So every corporation, every factory, every asset in the Soviet Union was owned by the government of the Soviet Union. And it was, and I'm not going to get into a debate on, you know, capitalism versus socialism or communism, whatever you want to call it, but it produced, anybody can look at the objective record, and it produced a tremendous amount of poverty. The paradox, I'll be just very quick on this, Scott, but I do want to get this point out because I talk about this every week in my class. The paradox about capitalism that people don't really understand is it produces enormous wealth. They understand that. And the price we pay is it produces inequality. There's some people that become fabulously rich, like Jeff Bezos, or other people like. I'm not just saying Jeff Bezos.
Sure.
Taylor Swift grossed $1 billion last year because of her incredible ability, her talent at writing songs that people want to pay large ticket prices to go and listen to. So the market economy produces much higher wealth, and anybody can study and look at the data from the UN or the World Bank or the IMF and look at the countries that are not market economies, and they have very, very low incomes. Think of Cuba. They're very poor. But there's a lot of equality in Cuba because everybody is equally poor. What we have in a market economy is there everyone is not equally poor. We have much higher standard of living, but the price we're paying is there's inequality between the top and the bottom, so that a Jeff Bezos or name your capitalist of the day has much greater wealth than everybody else.
But isn't it obscene? The argument is it's obscene that somebody has that much money, and so there are many people that could be helped if we would take the money and give it to them.
Well, when you say take the money, the wealth of these people that we're talking about now, we're not talking wage earners. We're not talking a wage earner who's the president of a university or a full prof or a CEO of a company that doesn't own the company. Now we're talking about the capitalist class, okay? And they don't, when people say, let's just take their money. Out there that they in the basement of their house somewhere or some vault somewhere, there's a stash of cash that Jeff Bezos has $200 billion of cash sitting somewhere in a vault. He does not. There is no such vault. Just like the bank, everyone thinks there's buckets, billions of dollars in the basement of each bank branch. There's none. The bank is all borrowed money. It's our deposits that then are turned around and lent out to fund mortgages, finance mortgages, car loans, businesses, etc. Bezos' wealth, as with any of these billionaires and multimillionaires, is in shares because they start a company, they grow the company, and the shares go up in value. So his wealth is paper wealth. I'm not trying to say to anybody it's not real. Of course it's real. But it only becomes money, if you want to use that phrase, when he sells the shares on the stock exchange. And then he pays capital gains tax on those shares. Same in Canada, same in Europe. So I'm just talking about the Western OECD countries. So there is a capital gains tax when the entrepreneur, the owner of the company, or the owner of any asset, sells an asset for a capital gain, unless it's your residence in Canada, your principal residence. Mm-hmm, let's leave that out, because
no government would dare. No government would ever dare bring forward a capital gains tax on primary residence.
By the way, and this is the dark and dirty secret that the liberals would never talk about. The largest, right now in Canada, we have about $19 trillion of wealth, of assets. Our net worth is $16 trillion in aggregate over all 30 million of us. That's about $400,000 a person. I showed that to my students. They say, what are you talking about? I'm not worth $400,000. I say, of course you're not. You're just 22 years old. You're a student. Us older boomers are worth a lot more than the average. But the average averaged out over all 30 million of us is about $400,000. But Scott, the thing I want everyone to remember is about 70% of that $19 trillion of wealth is, guess what? Real estate.
Yep.
So if we want to go after wealth in this country, contrary to the myth of, because remember, Jeff Bezos is an American and so is Bill Gates. I'm using American examples. We have very, very, very few billionaires in this country. And so contrary to the myth that there's vast amounts of wealth in this country that is owned by the billionaires, the vast amount of wealth in Canada, per Statistics Canada data, not my opinion. So please don't anybody write me and say that's your opinion. I'm dealing with the data from StatsCan. And most of the assets in this country are real estate. Now, some are owned by corporations, yes. Some are owned by nonprofits, and some are owned by government. But the vast majority of wealth in this country is real estate wealth, and it's owned by individuals like you and me. Yep. I own my house.
Yep. And as I said, we got to move along here, because I got one more thing to ask you. But I just, no government would have the cojones to say we are going to tax the sale of your private residence, because that's people's retirement. They would be voted out of office so fast their heads would spin. All right. One more thing. You've mentioned Taylor Swift a couple times. Fascinating name to bring up, because I think of this all the time. Why is it that when people get angry at billionaires for being rich, they point to Jeff Bezos and they point to Bill Gates and they point to David Thompson? Why is it that they point to those people, but they don't have a problem with Taylor Swift or with Michael Jordan or with LeBron James or other people who are billionaires?
Beyonce made $400 million last year.
Why do those people not bother us with money, but the business people do?
I have debated this for years in my classes. I've debated the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives with their cherry-picked list of the 100 CEOs that make around $5 million each. And they just get their knickers in a knot and get very, very upset about that. And I say, listen, $5 million a year for a CEO, I mean, that is a loony on the sidewalk for people in the entertainment business. I mean, I've got the Forbes celebrity list of the top 200 people. And you should see the salaries of LeBron James and soccer players and hockey players and football players and basketball players and Hollywood. I mean, Beyonce, $400 million last year. That dwarfs any CEO's salary, but you never hear anybody getting upset about that.
It's true.
In the odd time, students have said to me, well, it's because they earned it because of their skill as an entertainer. Yes, it is. But CEOs are not being paid a charity wage. They're being paid big bucks, as I like to tell my students, to produce very big results. And when you don't produce those big results, just like the NFL, do you know what they do? They fire you. They get rid of you. Seven coaches this year in the NFL got fired because they were losers. They
unless, Ian, we got to run. Unless you work for the government and you're the head of a branch that doesn't hit your mandates, you still get paid huge bonuses. And yet it's so ironic that it is the government that is talking about taking more taxes away from private citizens.
Yes.
If the example was shown that the government said our department failed to hit its targets, therefore our person, say the head of CBC, were going to not have bonuses and going to lose money, I think maybe some of the people in private sector might be more amenable to listen to this. But until that happens, I don't see it. Anyway, I wish we had a lot more time. I always love chatting with you. Ian Lee from the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. We'll do it again soon. Thank you for this.
Thanks very much, Scott. It was a real pleasure.
It is a fascinating one. Look, I completely understand. I absolutely understand the human natural reaction to say, why in the world should Jeff Bezos have $200 billion? It is obscene. I grant you, no human being should have that kind of money. I don't know human being needs that much. There are people in great need. I agree with all of that, 100%. But I do have enormous reservations and concerns about putting in place a system where the government can simply say, it's not fair, therefore we are taking away. If we have seen anything in recent days, just go and look at MAID. Now, we're not going to get into a debate about MAID, but if you want to say that there are no slippery slopes, go look at that. How it was supposed to just be for people who were on death's door with a terminal illness and where it is now. You're telling me that if we said, where anyone who's a billionaire, we will take their money away to help. You're telling me that that's going to stay there. That's not the case. And I also do wonder why it is that governments are the ones arguing often that people shouldn't just be able to make as much money as they want. Yet they are permitted to tax at any rate they want to make as much money as they can and want. That's what a government does. That's what taxes are. Governments decide how much money they want and how much money they need, and they tax accordingly or borrow. Governments do exactly the very thing that they are pointing the finger at those rich people. If governments would show leadership and restraint and better behavior with it, maybe more people would be open to the concept of things like this. Although, again, I'd be nervous about it. But governments don't. Governments are worse at this than most people.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
One real example of money and the kind of stuff that I think makes people a little bit crazy, maybe a little more than a little bit crazy. All right, let's back up just for a second, and I'll get to my guest in a second. I apologize to him in advance for keeping him on hold here. But we were just talking about the idea of a wealth tax. And there are people, and I don't dispute it for a second, there are people who feel very strongly that this is the right thing to do, that people who are very rich should pay more. And, you know, we can have that debate and we can talk about that, whether that's a good idea, bad idea, whether all that kind of stuff. But it doesn't help anybody's argument when the people who are in power who would create such a thing, execute such a thing, seem incapable of acting like normal people themselves when they decide that they deserve to live like the super wealthy. The only difference being if it's Jeff Bezos or whoever else, they're doing it on their dime. Government officials, politicians, when they do it, are doing it on our dime. That's what makes me so angry about this latest thing. And it is, when I say latest, it's because it's happened so many times now. Story that we learned about this week, that the Prime Minister and an entourage of something close to 50 people went on an Indo-Pacific glad-handing, fact-finding, saying hi mission, trying to, you know, bolster trade and everything else in the Indo-Pacific region. That's fine. We do those kind of things. That's what politicians do. But in this 6-day trip, $190,000 was spent for food on the plane. That's almost $3,900 per person eating food on a plane for 6 days. I don't know what your household budget is for groceries. It's not $3,900 a week. And let me bring in Franco Terrazano. He's the Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director. Franco, how are you today?
Hey, I'm okay. I mean, you're getting my blood boiling just reminding me of this story.
Well, here's the thing that I just don't get. And we can get into a bunch of things here in the time we have. But here's what I don't get. This is not the first time a story like this has come up. We had the Governor General getting raked over the coals for, I think, spending $100,000 and living lavishly when she went on a trip a while back. We've had other examples. The Prime Minister in London for the Queen's funeral when he stayed in the hotel that at first he didn't want to admit who was staying in that room and on and on. How is it that these politicians, knowing that people like you are going to be finding out this information, still don't seem to give a rip? Knowing that this is going to come out, they don't seem to care that people are going to see how much of our money they're spending. I don't get it.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but let me just remind with the details, okay? So this six-day trip to the Indo-Pacific, to like Singapore, India, Indonesia, six-day trip, folks, cost in total about $2 million. Now, included in that $2 million was about $200,000 spent on airplane food. Okay, let's break that down for a second here, because in Canada, so many people are struggling just with the price of groceries. I mean, we've heard of food banks seeing record lineups. Well, you know what $200,000 is? That's like the average family's grocery bill for almost two decades. Okay. And now you asked me the great question, and you know, it comes down to two things. Like, number one, we don't seem to be having politicians really exercising judgment. Okay. And one of the reasons that is because they become so financially detached from the people that they're supposed to represent. But another issue at play here is the bureaucracy, the unelected bureaucrats in Ottawa who are the ones who are managing these types of trips. There is nobody in the political class that are holding them accountable. So, you know, they can go out there and waste $2 million on a six-day trip, including 200,000 smackers on airplane food, and there is no one actually holding them accountable, right? When you have the fact that 90% of government executives are getting a bonus every year, it just kind of comes down to the point of it doesn't matter how you waste taxpayers' money. It doesn't matter how bad you make a mess of a situation. It's almost like you're getting a bonus anyways. So those are the two key issues here, among many others.
But okay, what was her name? I'm Bevoda. Who was the politician, the conservative?
Bevoda.
Okay.
Bevoda. What was it, like $16 orange juice or something like that?
That's right. So she got absolutely just hammered for spending $16 on a cup of orange juice, and I think most people said, "Yeah, that seems outrageous," but it was $16. How have we gone from that, where she resigned, as I recall, for that, to the point where politicians surely? The Prime Minister or anyone else who's an elected official can say to somebody, okay, we're traveling, but can we try and keep this, you know, so I don't come home and get hammered for this? Can we just eat like normal people? When you and I go on a flight, and if I do buy a meal on a flight, they are expensive. It might be $16 for a sandwich or something. All right. I don't expect our politicians not to eat. I don't expect our politicians to eat garbage. But $200,000 for 50 people for 6 days, surely someone, Franco, has the capacity to say, we don't need to do this. Can we please just not do this again?
Yeah, no kidding. And not only do they waste your money, but then they try to hide it. Okay, and I want to go back to what happened at the Queen's funeral in London, England. Remember the story broke that somebody stayed in the $6,000 per night hotel room? And we all know who it was. You didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out who stayed in there. Okay, but they wouldn't admit it. The Prime Minister wouldn't admit it was himself. Then we filed an access to information request. The bureaucrats gave us the information and then redacted the name. So we had to launch a legal challenge with the Office of the Information Commissioner to force Trudeau to come clean with the public. And then when he finally came clean with the public, he announced it the same day that President Joe Biden was coming to town. An attempt to bury the story. So not only do they waste your money, but then they try to hide it and cover it up. Okay, and I do have to list you the long list of the things that have been going on here. Not only do you have this $2 million trip, $200,000 spent on airplane food, you have that Governor General's week-long trip to the Middle East. It costs more than $1 million, $100,000 on airplane food. Then you had the Governor General's four-day trip to Iceland, right? When they dropped $71,000 on limo services, despite the hotel being a 10-minute walk away from the main conference center. Then you have Trudeau dropping $61,000 at a star-studded anti-poverty summit in Manhattan hotels for 2 days. So this list goes on and on and on and on.
Okay, if you worked for a private sector company, unless you're the owner, I suppose if you're the owner of the company, you can do whatever the heck you want because ultimately it's your money. But if you are the vice president of something for a company and you go on a trip for the company and you have shareholders and you spend all kinds of money way beyond what's necessary, surely somebody, some of the shareholders or the president or CEO or whatever is going to say that's not acceptable and either fire you or ask you to pay it back or demand you never, ever, ever do it again. That doesn't ever seem to happen here.
Not only that, okay, let me show you the prime example of why this is even worse. Okay, when the story first came out, it was about a year, maybe a little bit more ago, when the Governor General dropped $100,000 on airplane food at that week-long trip to the Middle East. There was this whole dog and pony show in this parliamentary committee where they dragged the senior government officials, including some of the GG's top bureaucrats, to committee. Okay, they made this whole show about it, and they issued a report. And even one of the top government bureaucrats said, you know, taxpayers are not getting the oversight they deserve and we will make things better. That's what they said. We're sorry. Trust us. We'll do a better job next time. And now what happens? Well, the prime minister and his entourage, they didn't spend $100,000 on airplane food this time. They spent $200,000 on airplane food this time. So not only did they admit that they made a mistake, not only did they say that they were going to fix things, they didn't fix things. They made things worse and spent double the amount of money on airplane food that got them in trouble the first time.
We got to go. But what do you think the odds are that if the polls are correct and if Pierre Poilievre becomes prime minister and if Pierre Poilievre were to take a government trip that spent $200,000 on food in an airplane for 50 people over 6 days, what do you think the odds are that the opposition liberals who were in government will scream bloody murder about how much money has been spent?
Well, of course the opposition would. But you know who else would be upset if that were to happen with all those ifs? Canadians would be upset.
They should.
Right?
They should.
Because Mr. Poilievre has rightly been calling out the government's wasteful spending. Kudos to him. Now, if he ever is to form government, Canadians are, of course, going to remember that, you know, key plank of his promise and are going to hold him accountable. And if he doesn't clean up the waste, Canadians will remember and will be even more furious.
And they should. Absolutely they should, if that's the case. I don't care what stripe of government you are. I really don't. The fact that the government is the government now is irrelevant. It's our money. And I, you know, Franco, you and I have talked. I am not an anarchist. I am fine to pay taxes for reasonable things at reasonable amounts. The problem is governments don't seem to understand reasonable a lot of the time, and they think that we can just tax whatever because, you know, we got to pay for this stuff. No, you don't have to pay for this stuff. You don't have to do this stuff. I'll pay my taxes happily for the things that are important, but this stuff just infuriates me because it's so stupid.
Oh, it is, and it just begs the whole question of these people calling for new taxes. Like, seriously, do you really want to give these folks any more of your money? Like, this is how they're wasting it. They're just, you know, spending all this money essentially on themselves to fly around the world, do these fancy conferences, all while their Canadians back home are really going through a tough time.
Franco Terrazano, the Canadian director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me on tonight.
You know, that's, I want to reiterate that though, because I do feel this way. I don't object to paying taxes. I mean, we talk about taxes here and I get angry about it sometimes, but I don't object to paying taxes. I am fine with this. I understand that's part of the social contract. We're going to have roads and hospitals and education. I'm fine with doing my share. The problem that I have is that so often our taxes are going to stupid stuff like this that don't need to be spent because it's just enriching the politicians, or it's going to pet projects, or it's going to things that we don't need, or it's just being wasted on stupid stuff. If we had governments that ran efficiently, I think that almost everybody, I mean, there's anarchists, I get it, they wouldn't, but I think most everybody would say, I'm good to pay my share.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.